Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and your host for today. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you'll enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. Here are two of our upcoming Grown-Ups Forum events. On Monday, March 14th, Longevity Explorers Discussion Group. Better Aging, You, and Your Parents. March 14th at 2 p.m. to 3:30. That's the Aging and Technology Discussion Group. And then later in March, Wednesday, March 23rd, we'll have a talk on the book, The Missing Kennedy. This is a good lit program underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation, and it's spoken by the author of The Missing Kennedy, Elizabeth Kohler Pentecoff. She's a New York Times best-selling author and niece of the nun who took care of Rosemary Kennedy for 35 years. The experience of Rosemary Kennedy was the inspiration behind the Special Olympics and the Best Buddies program. These are just two of the many upcoming programs, and I invite you to check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now I'll begin today's program. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to listen to us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. First of all, I'd like to introduce Candice Milford. Candice Milford has been the lead director of marketing at the Sequoias San Francisco for the past 10 years and has served on nonprofit boards and the Commonwealth Club Grown-Ups Forum. Candice and John are both contributing authors to a graduate-level gerontology textbook called Long-Term Care Administration and Management, published by Springer Publishing in early 2014. John Milford has been in the retirement field for over 30 years, having opened and served as executive director for both the Carlisle and San Francisco Towers. After retiring 5 years ago, he co-founded Tech Enhanced Life, a public benefit corporation that is dedicated to not letting growing older get in the way. Offering insights, analysis, and decision support tools to make the challenges of growing older less challenging, and so people can spend more time doing what they love to do and less time searching for solutions and worrying. And now I'll turn over the program to Candice.
Welcome. You probably already discovered that massive amount of handouts on each of your chairs. That's for you to take home and study. We're not going to go through it one by one. But I think probably the most valuable handout of them all, in our humble opinion, is the last one, where we tried to simply ask 10 questions about the main types of business models of retirement living, and then answer the questions across the columns so you can scan from left to right and get the answer to each question according to whether it's an ownership model, co-housing, rental, non-equity, assisted living, or rental. So that's for you to take home and study. And the intent of this seminar this evening is really to get you thinking, as someone said, fact-find, but also to look inside yourself and think about who you are as a person, because some of these options require you to live in a community, and that just does not fit every person. I wanted to share a quick story about a friend of ours who, in post-work years, has spent the last 5 years touring the United States with her husband, reviewing 60 retirement communities. And she shared with us some valuable insights, and that is she learned about herself and what she could give up and what she couldn't. Currently, they're traveling the world. They packed their entire house up in a pod. It's in Florida. They've forgotten it's even there. They packed a suitcase and a backpack each, and they're traveling around the world while they can, while they have their good health. And their intent is to come back after this long journey and sell everything in the pod, move into a continuing care retirement community. They've narrowed it down to 3 out of the 60, and buy all new furniture. I share that because one of the things I hear a lot and we get stuck around is our possessions. And this is a very atypical example of a couple who has gleefully given it all up and is freed from that. The last thing I want to share with you is that within San Francisco particularly, or any metropolis area, you're simply going to have to compromise. We see people wanting to duplicate their homes in apartment building type living, and it just simply isn't possible. At the Sequoias, we have a wait list. The largest wait list, and most CCRCs do, the largest wait lists are for 2-bedroom apartments. Everybody wants them. But you may not get a full kitchen or a balcony or a private garden or large living spaces. So just know as you're entering this journey of research that compromise is certainly on the table.
I'd like to start with an overview of the retirement living options here in the Bay Area. First and foremost, everyone should know we are not selling anything. We just want to provide information so that people can draw their own conclusions about what's best for them when retirement living is on the table. We're going to discuss housing options with an emphasis on equity, ownership-based housing, and that's where you pay an entry fee to a community and then you actually have title to the apartment or property and maybe portion of the pro rata portion of the common areas. There are also entry fee communities I mentioned a little earlier where people pay a substantial entry fee but they don't have equity, so that when they're done with the apartment then it goes back to the ownership, to the management company. We'll talk about the village movement. There are villages formed and forming here in San Francisco, and villages are for people who want to stay in place at home and join a membership club that gives them social opportunities, it gives them connection to getting volunteer services in their home, and vetted vendors that people are confident with. So it just makes staying at home easier for a longer period of time. I think the most demand is for some transportation. We'll talk about NORCs. NORCs are naturally occurring retirement communities. And this can be a building, like an apartment building, where people moved out here in the 40s. They're rent controlled, and everybody's still there. And they're all in their 80s now. People can become stranded in their apartment buildings with rent control because they can't afford to leave. So that happens. And in neighborhoods, sometimes that happens. People decide that the children leave, and people decide they like their neighborhood, and they're going to stay, and they have neighbors who want to stay. It doesn't happen in many neighborhoods, but it does in some. So a naturally occurring retirement community can be a building. It can be a neighborhood. And then there are other choices, like home sharing that can take place. There's a national network called the Golden Girls Network, where people can go online and can apply. And older people that have a large home and are willing to have a tenant in the home with them, somebody that's compatible with them and their age and so forth, can share their home. Helps with expenses, socialization, and a number of other things. Golden Girls Network. Lily Pad Homes is another option. Lily Pad Homes is a concept that's springing up now in Corte Madera, and they're going through the permitting process, whereby they'll send a person into your house to assess whether it's suitable to build out a separate unit within the house with a separate entrance that someone could live in. That makes affordable housing a lot of times for an older person who doesn't need to rent a whole house. And it also provides economic support for the owner of the house. Lily Pad Homes. And then there are affinity group retirement living options. And these are groups, you know, there's a retirement community for postal workers. And there's a retirement community for RV people. And they can drive in and drive out. And they even have a care unit. If they need a tune-up, they can stay in the care unit for a bit and then take off again. But then the golfers, and you can imagine, there are all kinds of artist colonies and so forth. We've taken an example of five different living options and asked 10 questions of each and arranged them on the handout. That was the handout Candice pointed out. I think it's at the end of the packet. So you can get detailed information to compare and contrast these different options and what they mean economically to people. We are not able to discuss low-income housing or subsidized housing because that's a regulatory world unto itself, and we can't address that. The three main reasons that people move from their homes are for care, either managing future health care by moving into a community that has health care facilities in it, or to attenuate the cost of care, even if they're needed sooner. Or for companionship, not just care, but companionship. You know, people get isolated. People stay at home, and they're independent. They like to be independent. And then pretty soon you look out, and you take your trash out, and you don't know any of your neighbors anymore, and they don't know you. The neighborhood has changed, and you don't like to drive at night anymore, so you don't go to the evening things. And little bit, by being independent, a person can get isolated. So moving to a community that has events and things already going on provides for socialization. And then cost of home maintenance and maintaining a house. An older person sometimes will say, I've just had it. You know, if I have to deal this with this roof again, I'm leaving. And so people move. Once they move into a community, the maintenance is taken care of. All right. Let's talk about the village movement. For people who do stay home, I mentioned briefly that there are village organizations. I think there are probably 200 villages across the country now. These are membership organizations that people join, people who are older, they live at home, and they want to have access to a little help when they need it. So when a person joins a village, they offer what volunteer service they can do for someone else, and then when they need service, another member will come and help them, even if it's something like changing a high light bulb or changing a leaky faucet or something like that. There are lots of older people who have lots of skills with maintaining things around the house who are in the village and can help their neighbors. So they're a diverse group, and they're just committed to helping each other when there's a need. That way, people feel much safer at home. Before there was a village, we know a lady that lived in a Victorian with lots of steps and high ceilings, and she said that when her overhead light bulbs would go out, she would order fast food. And when the young person came to deliver it, she would meet them at the door with a light bulb and say, "Young man, would you mind putting this light bulb in for me?" And she said it always worked. We mentioned NORCs, naturally occurring retirement communities. It can be a building, it can be a neighborhood. I'm trying to think. I think the Brocklebank building here on Nob Hill is a NORC. A lot of older people there. And the Fontanas down by Ghirardelli Square have gotten to be NORCs. The management companies of these naturally occurring retirement communities sometimes buy subscriptions to the village for the older people who live in the building so that they have access to some help. And it takes a lot of pressure off the building managers who are now sliding toward being care managers. And so buying everybody a membership in the village makes economic sense and is a good thing for some of these management companies. Now, we haven't talked about co-housing. How many here have heard the term co-housing? Okay. Co-housing is fairly new. It's building an intentional community. And the way they start is that a group of like-minded people get together and decide that they want to build their own community and build it in a way that it's conducive to socialization. So they're usually not that big a project. It's usually under 30 units. It's like a condo. People are like a co-op. People own their apartment. But there is also common space for dining, for cooking and dining for people that want to do that in common, and also some recreational space. But it's open. It's an open atmosphere type of thing, and people like that. It's run on consensus. Decisions are made in most co-housing projects by the consensus of the people that live there. They interview the people that want to come in, and they make decisions about how to run the place. Something that was greatly sought after by my residents at the Towers. But when you move into a community that's owned and operated by a management company, those decisions are made by the management company. Very different from co-housing. So co-housing is a lot more flexible for people. Right, Candice, can you tell us about month-to-month rental and so forth?
Before we leave this slide, though, this is a picture of Swan's Way over in Oakland, and it's a repurposed produce market that was built in the 40s, I believe. Swan's Market, yes, yeah. And you can see how they use that common space. They face in so that people have to walk by each other's homes on the way home, and it's a way to build in socialization.
So where does that fit?
This is part of co-housing. This is co-housing. It was. Did you mention it was started in Denmark? And it is. There's 47 of them, by the way, in the state of California. 21 of them in the Bay Area, and they are building more and more. They tend to be more out in the burbs. We don't have any in San Francisco. Meanwhile, back to month-to-month rental. There are very few buildings that were built for people 65-plus to be month-to-month. Many of them, as you just discovered, become that way, like NORCs. But and you'll see on your sheet that we discussed earlier that there are several. Two of the most well-known ones here in San Francisco are the Broadmoor and Peninsula Del Rey. They tend to have include meals and weekly housekeeping. Pricing, by the way, is also on that sheet, but I'll just mention that, for example, at the Broadmoor, you could pay between $3,000 and $6,000 a month for an apartment, and $1,000 for the second person. That's a building that's over on Sutter and Goff. It's been there for years. A newer one is called Peninsula Del Rey, and that's out in Daly City off 280. So it's less centrally located, but it is newer. So it has things that the Broadmoor can't, like a pool. It's 50-50, independent living and assisted living services at the Peninsula Del Rey, for which you pay extra. At the Broadmoor, they don't offer that. Again, you'd have to pay extra. So we're not going to linger too long on rental because there's just not many options. But sometimes when people move into communities and they sell their home and the timing isn't right for their apartment to be ready, sometimes these are communities where you can stay for a month or two until your next moving, your next home is ready for you to move into. Assisted living. I'm just going to use a couple of examples. Rhoda Goldman, we'll talk about in terms of money. But these are communities that are really designed for people who are experiencing physical changes, usually due to age. So they have personal assistants that can help you with the activities of daily living, otherwise known in the industry as ADLs, and that would be feeding, clothing, bathing, medication management, and helping get up and down. So you're in kind of a declined state. Obviously, people put this choice off as long as possible. So the average age of these communities tends to be higher than continuing care communities. They've been edging up. In fact, over the years, the average age has gone up in these communities to be at the high end of the 80s. People generally live there 2 to 3 years, and some of them offer memory care programs, although not all of them do. Rhoda Goldman does. Again, pricing is on your sheet, but a one-bedroom, just to get it out there, starts at about $6,000, and in that case, it includes all meals. That's a different pricing structure because most assisted living places have a fee structure whereby as your needs change, so does your monthly fee. For every level of additional help that you need, they may tack on another $500 and on up until you're so acute you can't be there anymore. At Rhoda Goldman, that price is all inclusive, which is unusual. It's not typical. We have planned adult communities. Can't forget those. Those are really popular in the 60s with the Del Webb communities that were began in Sun City, Arizona. They're actually still building them, but they've found that the boomers don't want to live out in the periphery. They want to be closer to the city, so they're having to try and find property closer to cities and build condos in some of the larger suburbs like Washington, D.C. The closest one to here, I think, is probably in Cloverdale, which is up north of here. And that is where you could probably duplicate your home in terms of having your full kitchen and your garden and things of that sort. But sometimes they're not that easy to sell. So that's something to keep in mind. Around the Bay Area, I just gave a selection of, in Marin, we have Smith Ranch Road. Rossmore is a city unto itself. It's enormous. 30,000 people live in Rossmore. Del Webb, as I mentioned, and then The Woods is actually a community of Northern California Presbyterian homes up in Mendocino, and people lease the land and bring in manufactured homes and live there. So it's a 55-plus community. Now we're going to mention affinity-based communities. This is where there's a lot of creativity. John mentioned a couple earlier. The reason we're mentioning it, even though these particular ones I'm going to mention are not in the Bay Area, because of the volume of people reaching retirement age, we really better get creative about living options because aging in place at home simply isn't going to work for everyone. You've got artists, for example. There's a couple that I know down in Los Angeles. The one on the screen is NoHo Senior Artist Community for people 62 plus It's in Hollywood, and they have an adjacent performing arts theater. They have studios and other educational programs from publishing to creating films. I have a friend who lives in another one in Burbank, and somehow in her late 70s, she's now in a television show. John mentioned the RVers. For those who hit the road when they're finally free of their work clothes and want to see the world. But then let's say you have a medical event. What do you do? Where do you go? This place is in Livingston, Texas, and they have 35 spots where you can roll in and get, for $850 a month, you can get assisted and skilled nursing care on a monthly basis. I've never heard of any other one other than this one, but it's interesting to know about. Lassell Village is an example, even though it's in Massachusetts. They're becoming quite popular because these are communities for older adults built on college campuses, because a lot of people want to extend their learning in their retirement. So it really makes sense to put them right on campus. And there's a lot of great intergenerational collaboration that goes along. In the case of Lassell Village, you're going to love this. They require you to spend 450 hours a year either volunteering or taking classes. So you can choose how you want to do it, but that's one of the conditions of living there. So they really want people who are going to be engaged, like-minded people. And finally, a lot of continuing care retirement communities, if you've ever visited them, are often likened to living on cruise ships. So yes, indeed, there are a few cruise ships, real ships, that you can purchase condominiums and actually live on and travel the world. One of them is being built now in South Korea. It's to the tune of $1.1 billion for 190 residences, starting at $3.5 million up to $30 million. So this isn't for the faint of heart. The downside is, yes, you may have a doctor on board, but you wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have activities directed towards your interests as an older group, and they wouldn't have the levels of care. But you sure could live well. And finally, we'll talk about continuing care retirement communities. This is a picture of the Sequoias, that giant building on, somebody asked me where it is. It's on Geary between Laguna and Gough. I'm simply using that as an example, not to push it, because there are three of these in San Francisco, the Heritage down on Bay, and of course the San Francisco Towers. We're most likened to the San Francisco Towers. Some of them are freestanding, like the Heritage. It's one of a kind. The Sequoias is part of a larger group called Northern California Presbyterian Homes, and they have seven communities. And the Towers has, I believe, 9 to 10 communities, and it's run by Episcopal Senior Communities. There's a whole list in your handout of all 109 CCRCs in California and where they are. There are also two lists, so you can see that some are operated and managed by for-profit operations, and others are not-for-profit. You have to apply to move in here through a financial and a health screen to be in good health for your age. Everybody's viewed through the same lens and criteria. And once you're in the community, they have within the building assisted living, skilled nursing care, that 24-hour nurses on hand. They usually have a clinic. They can have physicians where you can drop in and have your primary care done there. And in some of them, they have memory care floors, like in the Sequoias. Sometimes these skilled nursing centers are nearby, like Smith Ranch Road up in San Rafael. It's not really on the campus, but it's around the corner, so it's nearby. Most of these started in a faith base. That's why you hear all these allusions to religion. But due to fair housing laws, everyone is welcome now. But it was a natural extension to come out of churches because churches take care of their own. So that's some of the background behind CCRCs. And I think it's your turn now.
With continuing care retirement communities, one of the most common associations is the entry fee. And people ask, what's the entry fee about? An entry fee in a continuing care community is usually a couple of hundred thousand up to as much as you can imagine. The average is probably $600,000 or $700,000 for an entry fee. The purpose of the entry fee is to help the builder, the owner, offset the cost of the building and replacing portions of the building as they need to be replaced. So most of the entry fee goes to the building. Where there's health care involved, it's also prepaid medical care, prepaid health care. And many people who enter a CCRC and pay a hefty entry fee, the year in which they pay it, the IRS will allow as much as 30% of that entry fee as prepaid medical. So there is a tax advantage depending on your situation. And that has taken some of the sting out of it for people. But the entry fee is for that purpose. And then, of course, the monthly fees pay for the day-to-day services, the staff, the food, the housekeeping, everything else that goes along with day-to-day service of the residents. And that usually runs somewhere between $5,000 and $8,000 a month. Now, some people say, well, why not have a smaller entry fee and a bigger monthly fee? And that could be done. There's no magic. All the costs have to be covered. So the way the thing is put together now, usually the entry fees are substantial so that the monthly fees don't have to be any higher than they have to be. So that's what entry fees are about. Historically, they're not refundable. But as time's gone on, Candice will talk about some contract options that people have so that some of that money can come back. Now, the application process is open to people 62 and older in CCRCs, and there's no upper age limit. People used to ask me, well, do you have an upper age limit? And we thought, well, maybe we should have an upper age limit. But it turned out that it's really not about age. Age is a poor metric. It's really about functional ability. I had a lady who was applying and came to see me at 88, and I felt very badly because I felt at 88 we were taking a large entry fee from her, and she wouldn't be there all that long. And I told her I didn't think it was in her best interest. I said, I really discourage you. Well, she came back 3 years later when she was 91, and she had two of my residents with her, and they said, you must admit this woman. She is the life of the party. She's healthy and all that. And I said, well, you win. But there's nothing worse than a facility taking an enormous entry fee and then having somebody pass away 18 months later. What do you think the family thinks about that? So entry fees have their upside and their downside. And I think repayability is really the answer to that dilemma. So no more cap on age. Here's another thing. Formality of the community. You know, a lot of times it's really about a personality, whether a community is right for you. Visit a place, get the tone of it, see if you're comfortable there. At the Towers, we have people who are comfortable with more formal formality. We started with a dress code in the dining room, where men wear coats and ties to dinner, and it's required, and ladies dress accordingly. And when we opened, everybody liked it. By the time 15 years later that I was ready to retire, they were ready to run me out because they didn't want a formal dress code. And so there was that tension going on. But I did have to remind people of this. There are advantages to a formal dress code. Our mortality rate was substantially less than other communities with a relaxed dress code. And that was, as I was told by the maitre d', that the Grim Reaper had appeared at the dining room on various occasions and been turned away because he didn't have a coat and tie. People generally need to be in good health for their age, feel comfortable with the tone of the community, and the management needs to be sure that we have people in the community who will be healthy for long enough before they need to be in the care units, that we have care unit space available for residents when they need it. It is a career-ending opportunity for an executive director to have a building full of people, have his care units full, and his people have to go out to a nursing facility. So watching the census in the care units is a really important part of managing a multi-level retirement community. Now, independent living in a multi-level community is attractive to people because people like to be independent, but with the protections that CCRC offers and assures that people will have care when they need the care, it's also a licensed environment, and there are times when a person needs enough care in his apartment or her apartment that from a licensing standpoint, it's not even allowed for the management to let that care go on. If a person needs skilled nursing care in their apartment and the attention of a nurse on a daily basis, a CCRC multi-level place, the licensing people want to see that happening in the nursing unit, not in the person's apartment. Many people think that's not fair, that they are independent, they came in and paid all this money, and they want to be in their apartment and have their care in their apartment. So there's a tension there between being guaranteed care, but being guaranteed care on the terms of the license and regulations in a multi-level place. Now, residents that spend their hard-earned savings to come into a CCRC and pay a large entry fee and large monthly fees are protected by Department of Social Services in California. Department of Social Services has a special branch that vets providers and developers who want to build a CCRC, and they require heavy reserves, heavy bonding, background checking, backwards and forwards, and these are all protections for older people because nobody in the regulatory side wants to see older people come in, put their money into a project, and then halfway through development it fails. So by the time you see advertising for a retirement project in California, you can be comfortable that they've been well vetted and everything's been put in place to see to it that it doesn't fail financially. They look at the balance sheets periodically for all of the CCRCs. Every 5 years, their CCRCs have a 20-year actuarial study done to make sure that the ages of the residents and the money that's coming in and everything is in and the reserves are in balance to make sure it's going to be a going concern. There's an annual review by Department of Social Services staff, and if there's a nursing unit in there, Department of Health Services comes in, and their health service inspection, unannounced every year, is just as tough as it is in freestanding nursing homes. So there's a lot of protection for people who do come into licensed CCRC communities. Then, of course, there's the annual audit by the third-party auditor. Now, some people say, well, you know, a lot of these communities are not-for-profit, and we feel good about that because it's really expensive and we don't want to think we're lining the pockets of offshore investors. And, you know, the truth is there are more for-profit developers now in California of continuing care places and retirement places. And you can't really say that for-profit places are not up to par with not-for-profits. It really is a matter of judging the quality of the services and the reputation in the community. What for-profit operators have to face is that they have to charge enough and keep enough that they can give a return to the investors. That's what the for-profit burden is, to give a return to investors. Now, not-for-profits can take what would have otherwise gone to investors and plow it back into the operation or into reserves. So it's a little bit, some people are a lot more comfortable with that. It's really a matter of seeing whether the operation is giving top quality services, and if a for-profit operator can do that, and there are ones that do, then that's fine. It doesn't matter. Now, one of the things that not-for-profits in California have to do that for-profits don't is that if you come into a community, a CCRC, pay your entry fee, pay your monthly fee, you live there, you have a contract. If you run out of funds, in order for you to keep your not-for-profit status and your property tax-exempt status, it has to be in the contract that if a person exhausts their funds, that they'll be taken care of. Nobody is put out of a not-for-profit CCRC because they've outlived their funds. Now, and believe me, it happens. It's not frequent, but it happens. So I'm glad to see that work. And that's a protection in a not-for-profit that you won't see in a for-profit operator. All right. I think we'll go now. Candice, will you talk about contract types? Because they do vary. After people pay their entry fee, then they could have a different contract.
The traditional contract that most CCRCs offered was something called life care. And we call it the golden contract because it basically says that if and when you need more care, it is provided within the building and it does not trigger a fee increase just because you need more care. Here, a very vivid example is you need a knee done. You go to the hospital, have your surgery done. You come back to the skilled nursing center at the community where you live, and you get rehab on site. And let's say you're there for 2 or 3 weeks until they feel that you're safe to go back to your apartment. Well, during that time, you're living in two places on paper. In a CCRC world, you're only paying for the apartment. In that same scenario in your home, if you went and had that same surgery done, you'd still have to pay your mortgage and whatever wasn't covered by your insurances for the skilled nursing part of your care. So that, in a nutshell, is what life care is about. There is a one-time entry fee that depends on how big the apartment is and how high it is, if views are an issue. And then the monthly fees, which you heard about earlier, which are more about the services consumed. But as time has gone on, when I started in this business 10 years ago, there were 17 communities that offered this contract in the state of California. Today, there are only 10. And the reason is that all the risk is on the operator. That's as an a community gets older, such as Sequoias, there's more what we call acuity there, i.e., it's an aging population and more people are winding up needing care in the higher levels of care. And I lost my train of thought. But anyway, let's just move on and I'll find it. I was talking about how life care is on the wane. It's very expensive to care for people in these skilled nursing centers. So one of the reasons that life care is actually on the wane on a national basis as well is because of the cost of providing care. That's why in the last few years you'll see more communities offering a couple more types of contracts. They're called C contracts or continuing care contracts. And they generally have less monthly fee up front and less of a monthly fee. The assumption is that you either have deep pockets and you're going to self-insure and pay for the higher levels of care on top of your monthly fee while you're needing the extra care. Or that you have long-term care insurance, because more and more people are presenting with long-term care policies. But you really need to study these things very closely and do the math, because what we see at the Sequoias, for example, is a lot of people who are armed with great insurances and supplemental policies and Medicare and long-term care policies look at the numbers and say, you know what, life care is the better deal because there's no qualifying period like there is in long-term care policies. When you get long-term care policies, you elect for a qualifying period out of, during which time you're paying out of pocket. There is no such thing in a life care contract. When you need it, you get it. There's no lifetime cap in a lifetime life care product, but there is in a long-term care policy. And some people elect not to have inflation built into their policies, so when they say, I'm going to take that C contract, and then they wind up in the health center and they look at their policy that they got 20 years ago without inflation built into that daily rate in a skilled nursing center, it's pretty shocking to see that $150 a day doesn't get anywhere near the $380+ a day that it is now. So if you're looking at long-term care insurance, think about that. But
could you say in a nutshell the difference between type A, type B, and type C?
Well, type A is as it says, extensive. I've just described that to you. The B, a good example, as I've shown you on the slide, that's a picture of the V down in Palo Alto. Whenever I don't mention the V in Palo Alto, people ask me why. So there it is. But it isn't a life care community. It is a type B life care community. And that means that they guarantee you a certain number of days in the skilled nursing center during your lifetime, after which you pay a discounted rate on top of your monthly fee for that. So be sure when you're asking questions of these marketing people, ask if it's an A or a B. And it's pretty alarming. Sometimes they don't really know how to answer you, which I think tells a lot about their knowledge of the product. But that's a very important difference. Fee-for-service is what we just described, where you're self-insuring and using your own finances or long-term care.
You mentioned the V in Palo Alto. We visited the V in Ohio, and I was under the impression that that was a type A.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the V in Palo Alto. This gentleman said he visited the V in La Jolla. They have several. They renamed it from Classic Residence by Hyatt because the residents sued them. They said they were upstreaming the money to the corporate headquarters in Chicago, and the residents won. Anyway, the one in Palo Alto is a B. I don't know about the one down in La Jolla. But do ask when you go and see what kind of answer you get. Yeah. There's another little nuance here you should be alert about, and that is that because the movement is away from life care as a product, their Episcopal Senior Communities, for one, has renamed their product Lifetime Care. So be sure to ask, if you go to that community, what the difference is. My understanding is that it has to do with the amortization period of the entry fee. In these CCRCs, they amortize the entrance fee at about 1.5% per month. So after 5.5 years, should you choose to move out, which you can do anytime, you don't get any money back. So I think at the Sequoias it's 60 months. I think it's 48 at the Towers, but do ask that question. The other difference is that, I mentioned earlier that they have clinics with physicians on site under the life care contract. The Sequoias will pay copayments and deductibles of Medicare covered services under the life care contract. Under the lifetime contract at the San Francisco Towers and St. Paul's and wherever communities they have, they do not pay those. So those are little nuances that do result in money out of your pocket. So be sure to ask about that. They also have repayable contracts. The third one that we offer at the Sequoias is a C repayable contract. And what you'll see is that the entry fee balloons 40% more at the Sequoias anyway, using that as an example, more than the life care contract, because when let's say there's a couple in the apartment and both of them die, the estate will get, in our contract, they're all different, but in ours it's 90% is repaid to the estate through the entry fee paid to the Sequoias of the recontract of that apartment. So I'm making a distinction here between refund and repayment, and it's a legal term. Refunds, you're going to have set aside that money, and when the apartment is vacated through death or higher level of care, the money is immediately paid to the estate. But repayment is a whole other deal. And it, as I said earlier, and it's important to understand this, the community doesn't pay you until they get someone to recontract that apartment, and that's when you get paid. And one of the things up in legislation in Sacramento right now is to define that period of time, because it's left very gray in the contracts. They don't say that you have to be paid within a certain period of time. There's a lot of trust that the people will act in good faith and try and market that. But it's frankly makes me uncomfortable. And but interestingly enough, not many people opt for these the repayment contracts. The smartest people who do were are people in their late 80s and early 90s who know their actuarial life is short, and we used to offer a repayment life care contract. Well, if you know you only have 5 years, you know, you're locked in. You know that regardless of the ups and downs of the stock market, that your estate is going to get 90% of what you paid. So, and it's locked in. So we found, we had that contract option at one time, thinking it would attract younger people. And in fact, it attracted an older demographic. So that was interesting. I know the Towers offers the 90% repayment lifetime contract.
We're doing summary and questions. I think you had some slides that had to do with comparing costs and apartments and all that, but those are all in the handouts. I don't think we'll go footsore and weary through these slides. But we have given a general overview of the types of retirement housing, the business models, and so forth that are available outside your home if you're ready to leave your home and seek one of those types. You have your handouts, And now I'd like to open it up to questions. And Candice, right behind you there is a microphone. Would you mind passing the mic to people that have questions? And, you know, speak right into the mic. There you go.
Give us your name if you didn't get a handout, and we'll make sure that we get them to you. I can email them to you. Questions?
I can remember several years ago, a neighbor on Telegraph Hill had to give up her home earlier than she wanted to because she wanted to go into the Heritage. There was an age limit at the time, and you had to be able to get in under your own power, so to speak. Right. Is that still a prevalent characteristic of this type of housing or not?
You know, in some communities, it's still in place. When we opened San Francisco Towers, we had a nominal age limit, and it turned out it really wasn't practical. So we didn't use it anymore. But other communities have a right to do that. I mean, it's a business. And I think they're concerned about keeping the average age at a level that's where they're reasonably able to provide care for everyone. If everyone that comes in needs care 6 weeks later, the model would collapse. That's why they want an age limit.
A couple of things about that. I love stats, and you might like to know that, for example, at the Sequoias, this is probably true of a lot of CCRCs, the average age is around 78 coming in. Not to say that we aren't seeing a lot more people in their late 60s coming in, and the wait list is full of them because there's only a limited number of properties and they're planning ahead because planners come to communities. The average age in a lot of these CCRCs is much higher. It's about 84. But as I mentioned earlier, the Towers is how old now? 20-something years old?
Probably 18.
18 years old. Well, the Sequoias is 46 years old. We have people that have lived there 20 and 30 years. So that's why the average age is torqued to the upper end. But that gave us the opportunity, all that history, to study what we see in the clinic. What we saw in the clinic is why at one point we had an upper age limit of 83. Because in the clinic, we could prove that people who moved in at 83 or older hit the clinic more immediately and with more frequency than those who came in at younger age. That said, due to fair housing and all of those laws, you just have to be 65 and above, and there is no upper age limit. I think the oldest one that applied successfully was 92.
Yes, I was wondering, when you have a contract with one of these facilities, is the monthly payment then frozen, or does that go up?
The monthly fee is set at the time of entry, but it's adjusted annually for the increase in the cost of services. And I think across the industry it varies between 5% in a bad year. You know, it's all about covering the cost of taking care of people. When we opened the Towers, we gave the whole nine yards. We had restaurant service. It was just wonderful. And then we realized we were losing a rather remarkable amount of money. And what I had to do with the resident council was to tell them that we were looking at a substantial monthly fee increase in the year to come, unless we made some adjustments. And I just asked them. I said, what are we doing too much of? What do you really don't care for? And I had my department managers make a list of things that they could reduce and how much money that meant. I gave that to the resident leadership. They studied it. They agreed with 9 out of 12. And we were able to bring the monthly fee increase down under 6%. It would have been 14%. So it's really, there's no magic. It's just a matter of managing expense and expectations. And I found that letting people who live there participate in making some of those decisions really cooled the process down.
also in the contracts that you sign by law in California, you're given a 5-year history so you can see what the trend has been, but there is no upper end cap. So don't. And the other thing people often think is that it reflects the inflation that is occurring in the world in which we live, and it absolutely has nothing to do with that. As John said, it has to do with the cost of operations.
Steve.
Thanks very much. Excellent. Can you go and sort of look at that village column and can you explain that a little better for us? So it's a village.
The question was about explaining the village model, and just briefly, it's a membership model. You pay a monthly fee. I think it's $600 a year divided by 12. And so on this chart that you're seeing on the screen here, we're saying that if you needed assisted living services, you probably would have to hire a home health aide through a company that screens for background checks and fingerprinting and all of that. And they could come to your home. They tend to be about $35 an hour. So we just calculated what an 8-hour day would be or more. But it's based on $35 an hour, which is the going rate. Most people don't need 24-hour care in their home, but I wanted to show you the extreme so you know that that's the worst it can be at this point in time. Does that help?
Thank you. Yeah, I have a couple of questions about the CCRC refundable entrance fee model because I haven't been able to get answers that are clear to me from some places. It seems to me two things. One is there's a model where you pay a large amount of money up front, and then you get maybe 90% back when you die. And I understand that's the business model of the organization, but it seems to me there's a couple of options with that. And one is, as you said, nonprofits don't, I didn't know this before, but you said nonprofits won't kick you out if you run out of funds, basically. But I would have thought with that model, I mean, there they are, if you happen to run out of money, there they are sitting on paper, 90% of $1 million, say, so $900,000. Why would they not go into that like the equivalent of doing a reverse mortgage and say your estate will get less back? That's one question.
Well, you know what? You're prescient because you figured it out. They will do that.
They will. Okay.
They will do that.
And the other is, I've had some discussion saying, I don't have any dependents. Like, there's some charities I would leave some money to, but I'm not interested in ending up with a lot of money. I'd rather pay less to get in and get much less back. So, rather than leaving a very nice estate to somebody. Are those options in that are becoming more available?
Well, I know with the not-for-profits, it's and Candice can say more about this, but there are options to take out an annuity.
Charitable annuity or a charitable unit trust.
Yeah. Right, where people would like donate their property, their house or property to the not-for-profit foundation. And then they would be receiving a flow of cash every month that would help offset the cost of their stay there. That's a popular thing. Yeah.
Questions?
Okay.
Okay.
I think we've exhausted
some more questions. I think there have been a couple high-profile articles in the Sunday paper about people in Palo Alto being forced out of their units and into, I guess, 24-hour care facilities at a stage when their health was still, they felt good. And there have been lawsuits down there over that. I think it's
It's dicey to talk about
that. How can you decide?
Well, remember when I said when you come into a CCRC, you have regulations and things that protect you, but they also require that if you need a certain level of care. That management was in a vice because the regulators were requiring them to see to it that this person have their care in a licensed care unit. This person said, I'll have none of it. I'm staying in my apartment. And if you try and move me, I'll sue you. And so it became a legal issue. But it was a real dilemma between the regulators who were putting pressure on the management and the independence of the person who just wouldn't yield to the rules of the place. And, you know, that's human. That happens. And I'm sure it got worked out.
Can I just add a little bit? Because there are criteria that are measured, and you are allowed by law, and it's in the contract, to have family meetings. There's a whole appendix in the contract that says you have to go through certain steps with your care circle, your doctor, you, your DPOA, anybody you appoint to be in that discussion group. You have an initial care conference, a second care conference, a department review, a 30-day letter. And by the time you get to that 30-day letter, you may already be in the higher level of care, but you have plenty of opportunity to participate if you can. And I say that because of cognitive issues, which is where the DPOA may come in. But anyway, it is not arbitrary by any means. And there is no time frame on that, by the way. It is unique to you. A stroke that's paralyzing and irreversible, bam, I think we all agree, you would need to get 24-hour care. If it's a slow cognitive decline, that's a whole other process. It could take a year or more. So there is a consideration for that.
Mm-hmm. One more question, and our time is about gone, but we'll answer questions if you want to stay and ask after we close the program.
Thank you. My question goes in that same area. Suppose somebody is recovering from something or not recovering and needs some level of assistance, for example, help in bathing daily. They're able to stay in their apartment, but they need this level of assistance. Do they have to go to the extended care facility, or do they provide somebody to help with bathing and maybe that sort of thing?
Continuing care communities expect to provide some assistance to people in their apartments. Our rule of thumb was 2 hours a day. If it got beyond 2 hours a day of person-to-person help, then we started having the conversation. I think the thing that brought most people got most people in trouble was the fact that they would have trouble managing their medications and they'd get their meds wrong and things like that. We actually worked around that by having them come down to the clinic every day and take their medicine there with the nursing people in the clinics. We found if we could keep people regular on their medications, they could be safe in their apartments for years. But if they didn't have help, it didn't take long before there was trouble. One last question.
My question is, what if you have an elderly relative who does not want to go from their home, who needs to go? I mean, how can you deal with this?
That's another program. And I'll bet everybody here would come to it. But can we talk afterwards? Good. We're going to have to close now. But we want to thank Candice and John for their expertise on the program on retirement options tonight. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.